Please listen carefully.
Hello, universe. Welcome to the Optimist Daily Update. I'm Summers McKay.
And I'm Christy Jansen. And we are part of the team behind the Optimist Daily, making solutions the news. We bring you reader-funded solutions news every day in order to change the tenor of news media, social media, and the direction of your day to help make it one focused on solutions.
7 days a week, we publish positive news stories written by award-winning journalists and delivered online to your inbox and through our social channels. And also, we are sharing these solutions in commute-worthy, walk-worthy, home office-worthy, learn something while you're moving-worthy podcast. Today is Thursday, the 9th of September, 2021. Just thought I'd throw back to yesterday's discussion of our Optimist Daily Challenge to open this one up, Christy, because we're going to learn stuff today, aren't we?
We are. Absolutely. I'm excited about today's show.
Well, before we get into today's show, I have a little update on my garden. Oh. Remember how I was so excited that my geraniums, my buckets and buckets of geraniums that I had brought from Ojai to Austin, Texas, that were all my Ojai rose geranium flowers that had flourished so beautifully for so long in our home in California, and actually were doing really, really well here. Well, Christy, in the span of the last 2 weeks, they are crispy dead.
Well, you know, I think they were California grown.
And I know.
They were not great transplants then, huh?
I did save one sprig, right? And it is currently in a vase in my kitchen, and I'm willing it to survive that perhaps I can make it a sprouting. But I am doing a lot of research into local Texas and native Texan flowers and plants so that I can support regionally the appropriate, you know, birds, bees, and bugs that are around here. And I'm kind of settling on some Texas sage, which I think will be a very good, very delicious plant for my garden. But
And for your bees and your bugs to come and take snacks from, right?
Exactly. You know, I was joking that the hummingbirds were all just so excited by our Ojai geraniums because they were like, what is this delicious sweet treat? But it was not to last. No. So,
wow.
Yes. So we are spending a year basically here getting to know this garden in this new home that we live in so that we can do the right thing for all the birds, bees, and bugs that live around here, which brings us to the topic of today.
You know, Summers, I think I have somebody for us to talk to and ask for some advice on
who's here today.
So we get to have a guest. This is our guest for today. We're going to be interviewing Kristen Klitgaard. She's an applied research lead at a company called BeeFlow, which we did a spotlight on our daily back in July.
Wasn't that one of those articles that did really, really well with
BeeFlow? It was. BeeFlow is a company that rents out their bee colonies to farmers to better pollinate the year's crops and improve yields. But BeeFlow does it a little bit differently because they also use technology and a well-researched combination of plant-based foods and molecules that, when fed to the bees, reduces their mortality rate and improves their ability to survive in cold weather. And so they have a specific nutritious food that they've designed. Mm-hmm. And they also have targeted methods to be strategic with where their bees go. So anyway, we invited Kristen to come on the show and talk a little bit about her work and what she does and why bees are so important for the world that we live in. So Kristen, welcome to the pod.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm excited to talk to you guys today.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about your personal background and how you got involved with this really interesting company.
So I studied biology in college, partially out of an interest, you know, to learn how we can better steward the world, and partially just because I love being outside. And throughout that process, I was mostly studying plants, but then I got involved in the lab on campus. I was working in Dr. Susan Mazur's lab at UC Santa Barbara, and I worked on a project with Kristen Peach to study pollinator attraction in wildflowers.
I love that her name is Peach, talking about pollination. And yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The perfect name. No, you're right.
Well, and really, you have a published work on this one that I just want to, is this the one that your first published work is about? I just want to read the headline of this one here. So this is sex-specific floral attraction traits in sequentially hermaphroditic species. That's it. I was like, species and, okay. That's and it.
We're not going to read the title of her other paper because there's too many tongue twisters in there that we don't, us non-science people don't really know how to pronounce. Epiphytic brophyte cover across tree species. I don't know. Something about that.
Now you're just showing off. So in the pre-pod record, we were talking about all of this amazing stuff that you have done. So this project that you were working on with Professor Peach or Dr. Peach.
Yes, currently Dr. Peach.
Yes, Dr. Peach. So you and Dr. Peach were working on this sex-specific floral attraction of bees. And is that really what got your love of bees going?
Yeah, it definitely is. It was just my first introduction to like how fascinatingly specific the relationships between pollinators and their plants that they're pollinating can be. And so that really turned me on to the pollinator world. And then further in my studies, I learned more about agriculture, and agricultural lands make up about 50% of the land surface on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that says if we can make a change in ag lands, then that can have a really big impact globally.
And it shows the interdependence of species which are considered, quotes, wild or natural, and then the sort of the areas of our world which are dedicated to human populations.
If we can increase what you're saying, like these wild pollinators in agricultural lands, or even just increase the biodiversity there at all, you know, that makes for a more resilient ecosystem.
Right, right. Well, cool. And then what does, tell us a little bit about BeeFlow and the approach that you're taking within the company, what its strategy is for protecting pollinators and building a more robust pollinator population.
So BeeFlow, we are a pollination company, and we're trying to bring a lot more science and data into the world of crop pollination. So as you guys have sort of hinted at, we do feed our bees a couple technologies, and we focus on where we're placing them on a farm to try and boost pollination. And then we also collect data throughout the course of a bloom to make a really good argument for the importance of good pollination to be able to demonstrate to growers what's really going on their farms during this pollination season. We also do a lot of research as a company, so that's more where my role comes in as the applied research lead. So sometimes we do trials comparing BeeFlow style of pollination to more conventional methods, or other times we're looking into crops that are just exploring using pollinators for the first time, or we are taking knowledge that has been sort of locked in academia potentially and trying to disseminate it downstream so that it can actually be put into practice in agricultural settings.
Hence the applied research.
Yes, all very application-based.
All very, and I think it's an interesting interaction between technology and research and, you know, standard agriculture, which there's that growing ag tech world. And do you fit into that with BeeFlow? Does BeeFlow kind of fit into that?
Definitely, we are in that ag tech, biotech world.
Let's take it back a notch. As you said, it's about making this accessible and the information applicable. For those of us who are bee groupies, we already know this answer, but for those who are maybe new to this whole conversation, Kristen, why do pollinators matter? Like, what are they and why do they matter?
Yeah, what are they is a really important part, because if you haven't taken a bio course or been studying bees, you know, it kind of gets hazy, the meaning of pollination at all. Pollination in general is really important because this is how we fertilize our flowers so that flowers can become fruits, which can become, you know, the food on your counter. So it's all about transporting pollen from the male portion of a flower called an anther to the female portion of a flower, which is called the stigma. And sometimes those two parts of a flower are in the same flower, and so they only have to really be transported a couple millimeters. But other times they're on two different flowers or on two different trees. And so it becomes increasingly difficult for the pollen to move to the perfect place. But luckily you get these pollinators. So these can be bees, they can be flies or butterflies, other insects, sometimes even birds and bats. And these are agents that are moving pollen between flowers to aid in this pollination process and the fertilization. And they're really, really important because 86% of all of the flowering plant species in the world need animal pollination to reproduce. And then if you look at just food crops, so what we are, you know, growing to eat, 75% of them will have an increase in production. So that might be more fruits produced or higher quality of fruit produced. And so they'll have an increase in that with animal pollination. And most of the time in agricultural settings, you're using honeybees because they have a suite of biological characteristics that make them sort of ideal agricultural pollinators. And so a lot ends up resting on these little bee shoulders in terms of what we're able to eat as humans.
That you paint such a perfect picture for us to understand it. Chrissy, I know you've got some other questions lined up. What else do we want to learn? I feel like I'm just like in happy bee wildflower land.
Me too. And I think they used to use the birds and the bees to talk about sexual reproduction at all. I don't think that that's really the mode now that we have sex class in most of our schools. We don't need that, but it's still it is a part of how things get made in this world and how we get our food and how plants have evolved. They've evolved depending on these kinds of animal pollinators, and they wouldn't exist without them. And likewise, bees wouldn't exist. So it sort of shows that symbiotic relationship that is a beneficial, the synergy between different kinds of species. I love that.
Yeah.
So how do you see what the work you're doing and bee flow in general supporting agriculture in the face of climate change, and as the impacts from that intensify, things like more heat and less moisture in some areas and more moisture in others, like how does the kind of work you're doing affect the growers and inform agriculture in general?
So as I was saying before, we're collecting a lot of data on pollination, and currently in agricultural practice, there's not a lot of data out there. Beekeepers traditionally will bring their bees to a farm and sort of drop them off and then not come back until the end of the bloom because their focus is more on making honey. So there's not anybody else who's really focused on pollination as a science, like BeeFlow is. And so for us, with this data we're collecting on pollination and with our techs that we're feeding them and all of this stuff, we're able to, again, make a good case to farmers about the importance of pollination. And hopefully, as we do that, we can also encourage farmers to incorporate different species of pollinators on their farms. So it's not just this Apis mellifera honeybee, but pollination actually works best when it's done as nature has designed it, you know, with a suite of different organisms. So if you have your honeybees and your native bees and maybe some bumblebees in there and some butterflies and all of these things, you know, then all of them actually make each other pollinate better.
So the data you're collecting, can you then show that by using your pollinators, it'll boost their production? Is there like a one-to-one correlation there?
Yeah. So when we do these trials of comparing bee flow pollination to more conventional services, we've shown an increase anywhere from 20 to 90%. In yields.
That's crazy.
And kiwis and almonds and blueberries and all of these different crops. And so again, if we can encourage these better practices with pollinators on farms, you create a more resilient ecosystem. So as these big climate change disaster events happen, your environment can respond better in the long run. You know, it's not just all one species that is going to collapse after one event.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what are the impacts of your work for the pollinators themselves? Do you feel like that you're also supporting the bees, the little critters that you're bringing to the sites?
Yeah. So for our honeybees, our feeds, it sort of boosts their immune system. So it helps them fend off some diseases, and also in colder weather helps them pollinate more. So they're able to be active in temperatures that they're normally restrained by. And so in that way, they're able to get more food and all this kind of stuff. And we encourage farmers to plant alternative forage on their farms so that bees can have a healthier diet. So it's not just, you know, one plant's pollen that they're eating.
Right. They're not just getting the sugar high from the cereal, but they also get some vegetables and greens.
Exactly.
To round out their diet.
So in that way, it's benefiting their pollinators as well. And we're you know, keen to keep track of our hive health throughout our services and make sure that they're doing well. And if one seems to be failing because we're there collecting data on it, we can act to make it better.
So then you can avoid the sort of colony collapse thing, right? Like you can perhaps see it coming or pay a little more. Because I know that understanding colony collapse has been a really concerning and interesting focus for folks who are in the bee industry.
Yeah. There's a few diseases that are pretty big in the bee industry, colony collapse disorder, which you're alluding to. And then there's like some viruses, Nosema. Those are some big ones. There's a lot of research that's dedicated to those things. We're not focused as much in those ones specifically, but we are, you know, monitoring our hive health and trying to prevent those things from happening by keeping them well fed and in environments, you know, that's not stressing them out too much or anything like that.
Can you tell me a little bit about your blueberry emergency that you had to cancel our interview for last month when you had
to run off? We found it very charming, but at the very last minute, Kristen, we got a message from our producer, Amelia, that Kristen was unavailable because there was a blueberry harvest emergency. And Kristen and I were like, can we help? We want to come. We want to harvest. What can we do? How does that happen? And what were you doing?
Yeah, so another part of our service is that we collect fruit quality data. So we pollinated these blueberries in Oregon and Washington earlier this year in April and March, and they're just ripening now or last month. And so we have to fly back and harvest some blueberries and weigh each individual blueberry or, you know, take a caliper millimeter measure of them to see how they're doing, how they compare. And because of these heat waves that have been happening in the Pacific Northwest, the blueberries ripened a lot earlier than they were supposed to.
We were originally
planning to go at the end of August, and then we called them to check in, and they said, oh no, we're going to harvest on Thursday. So Friday afternoon, we were like, okay, let's book a flight. Let's be there on Monday. Let's, you know, make it happen. Hence the emergency.
Hence the emergency. But it certainly is showing that impact of how a changing climate, the heating world, it impacts your work, and your work impacts that knowledge that you can collect from it.
Yes.
Do you have any like victories that you can talk about, stories about farmers or bees that you can share with us?
Something that's been really exciting for me recently, one of the projects we've been working on revolves around strawberries. So in California and in America, I think more broadly, in the strawberry growing industry, there's sort of an idea that strawberries are pollinated by the wind. So just rely on the wind to move the pollen around. But if you look at literature, or if you go outside of the United States, it's very well documented that strawberries really improve their quality when they have insect pollinators. So BeeFlow has been trying to make that knowledge more accessible. So we have reproduced some well-known studies on a few growers' farms. So we had, you know, a cage around some strawberries to say, these ones are not going to be pollinated by bees. And this cage has plastic, so they're not even going to be pollinated by the wind. It's just self-pollination. And then other plants that are totally exposed to the bees that we're putting on the farm. So we're able to compare, you know, these different treatments of pollination type or style. And we saw huge benefits to pollination, because when a strawberry is under-pollinated, it becomes malformed, and then you can't sell it, so it results in a lot of food waste. But we saw a 32% reduction in malformed strawberries with insect pollination, and growers are really responding to that and are excited about it. And so we have a few more projects coming up, still, you know, refining some of our techniques with strawberry pollination and seeing what we can do there. But
you guys kind of sit in the strawberry capital of California, right there in the Central Coast, right? Is BeeFlow a California-based company? It looks like you guys maybe came from somewhere else first. What's the trajectory of the business?
Yeah, so our company was started in Argentina, and we still have a team there based out of Buenos Aires. And then we have a team in California, in Ventura County. And we're working all across the United States and throughout Latin America as well. So this last season, we were in Washington and Oregon and Florida and Hawaii and Central Valley of California. And then we have a team in Peru and others in Argentina. But we're really trying to be global leaders in pollination as a company. Mm-hmm. So we're eager to find projects wherever we can.
So my question selfishly, and this is something that we talk about a lot on the Optimist Daily, is that solutions are regionally appropriate. There's not siloed. No one solution is a broad swipe for everyone. And as a global company, is your bee formula different for each hive in each, you know, region? How does your business differ as it takes on, you know, I guess a lot of it's about data and collection and learning at this point. But you guys must be coming up with locally appropriate solutions and decision-making for each area that you go into, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's really important to do that, especially in agriculture, because each field is going to be a different experience. So it's a lot of collaboration with the grower in a specific field, talking to them, designing projects with them, with our feeds. So we have one feed that's pretty standard, and that's the one that boosts the immunity of them, and it's a couple of plant compounds that a bee might naturally find, but helps them out. And mm-hmm. then another feed that we developed in conjunction with Dr. Walter Farina in Argentina. And that actually uses plant scents to increase the loyalty of bees and make them, you know, want to visit the one crop over any competing blooms. And so that feed that we give them will vary based on the farm that we're on, based on the crop that we're working in. But in general, we always have to scope out a farm before we arrive there to figure out where are we going to put our bees here? How are we going to collect data? Which plants are we going to tag? You know, it changes a lot depending on where we are.
So fascinating. So exciting.
And I like that BeeFlow itself has sort of that triple bottom line kind of orientation where you're touching on the economic benefits of pollination and then the social benefits of understanding your local area and bringing the farmers and communities in, and then also the environmental impact and how you can support a more sustainable agricultural system.
Yeah, I really like that too, because I think if we want these environmental solutions to, or social solutions as well, you know, to become, to have a real place in society and have a power to them, I suppose, I think that they need to be economically profitable as well. And why can't it, you know, benefit the farmers as they're striving for their livelihood? Farming is a hard business, and also can benefit the environment locally and the food that a consumer is receiving and a beekeeper whose hives are less likely to collapse now, you know, all of these things.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Summers, any other questions?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, I mean, look, we love hearing about companies that are doing well and doing good, and we love birds, bees, and bugs around here. I know that a lot of people who are listening want to know how they can help or what they can do. And even if they're not in big ag and they can't necessarily have BeeFlow come and bring a hive to their yard, what does like the average person, how can they help? How can they be part of the solution?
Yeah, I think so. There's a few things that come immediately to mind. One is sort of what you were talking about in the beginning, Summers, with your garden and getting some pollinator-friendly plants in there. That can really help. You know, if the habitat is really fragmented, pollinators have a difficult time traveling across space because there's nowhere for them to land and sort of like refuel. So if you have a garden with plants that can feed them, then they're able to nourish themselves there and continue moving across a landscape. Mm-hmm. And then otherwise, you can look for food. You know, there's a few different certifications for food that is bee friendly or I can't really think of one right now, but there's a few different, so you can actually see some companies are prioritizing having.
So you can have, oh, okay, so the food that we consume are like bee friendly. Yeah. Like back when we had like dolphin safe tuna, now there's bee friendly safe almonds or whatever. That's really interesting. I was unaware that was a label we could be looking for.
Yeah. So you choose an almond that doesn't use this one kind of pesticide or something like that, or
Yes, I know there's two organizations that are really working in the realm of certifications right now. One is the Xerces Society, another is Pollinator Partnership, but both of them have their own certification programs with different qualifications for the farm. So it might be that they have X percentage of land dedicated to pollinator habitat to promote not only your honeybees, but native pollinators as well. And then not using certain pesticides or only spraying at certain times. So that's another
I
way.
I feel an Optimist Daily solution is going to come from this, Christy. I'm excited.
I love it. We'll have to go look at that. It reminds me also when we talked with Nick Haddad, who's a conservation biologist that focuses on butterflies. And he was talking about pollinator strips along the edges of farms or on the edges of even ranging land, and how that makes a huge difference in being able to support local pollinators and even butterflies that are migrating, that even migratory pollinators, so they can actually move across not just a local landscape, but across, you know, a continent. So I think that's such an interesting concept to, and you're bringing that into the farms as well. So it's not just focused to the monoculture agriculture, but you've got at least some natural or local vegetation that responds to supporting the local population of bees and bugs and birds and such.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, Christy, I think even though we can talk for hours and hours, it's probably time for you to bring this fabulous interview home, because I need to go play in my garden. Go for it.
All right. So, Kristen, as we always do, we always like to end our conversations with our fun guests like yourself with a question about what makes you optimistic in today's world.
I think in regards to work, what makes me optimistic is seeing how growers respond to our company even existing. You know, they're excited about pollinators. They're wanting to incorporate them. It's just they need to learn how. And so a company like us or others like us have a lot of potential to grow and do good work there. And then in my personal life, just really good books. You know, they always bring compassion and joy and love of the world, I think.
Is there any book that you've read recently that you want to recommend to our audience?
Ooh, yes. I think if you're into poetry, any Mary Oliver poems really remind you of the joy of being in nature and are just so lovely to start your day with.
I'm right there with you. I love Mary Oliver.
Yeah.
Wild geese She's and all that.
Amazing.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for coming and sharing your knowledge and your wisdom. Anybody who listened to this podcast while you were walking, you probably learned something that you'll remember. If you listened to it sitting in your office, that's fine too. Everybody, this has been today's Optimist Daily Update. As always, we promise to continue to share positive solution-based stories with ideas on how you can participate in this changing world and ensure it is changed for the good. Please consider becoming an emissary on theoptimistdaily.com and for just $5 a month, support reader-funded independent journalism. That's how we keep our lights on, so become an emissary and check out BeeFlow on our Optimist Daily story and in the show notes. Kristen, thank you so much for being here. Christy, I'll see you tomorrow.
Bye, Summer. Bye, Kristen. Thanks so much.
Bye. It's such a pleasure to talk to you guys.